Breaking news.
Breaking news.
I'm pregnant.
Yeah, it's true. It's crazy, right?
It is. It's very crazy.
Babies, first watch list.
Babies. yeah, it's baby two.
For those of you who don't already know. Yeah.
Most people probably know. And it's not just baby two, it's boy two.
Boy two, yeah. Yeah, so we're going to, hopefully the goal is eventually to like have them both on.
And, like, eventually.
Eventually. Well, I'm thinking with our first one, like with our older one, maybe once he sort of understands what movies are in the next like year and a half, maybe.
Did you like it? No.
I just mean like maybe record a 30-second thing if I'm talking about the movie and just sort of plop it into the episode in like a segment.
That's cute.
You know, maybe something like that.
Yeah.
And then we could go back and we could be like, oh, we could be doing Avatar 4 and then have just a random like, oh, and by the way, here's our son's, our son's thoughts on the holdovers.
And then he'll know more words by then.
30 seconds on the holdovers. He's not going to be watching the holdovers probably that early, but
probably not.
It will make Baby's First Watch List, of course.
Saltburn, maybe soon.
Saltburn, maybe. Yeah, I would say within the next couple months. but yeah, so that's what we got going on. So also, if we are erratic, if we're not posting episodes, which is not in the plan, this is going to drop at a normal time. All the episodes have dropped at a normal time. We're just going to blame it on Erin being pregnant.
Yeah, which...
it's a reasonable excuse. Listen,
there's been a lot going on the past few months.
Yeah. Even if it's not the actual excuse for whatever the thing is, that's what the excuse is going
to
be.
It's always nice to have in a built-in excuse.
Built-in.
That's always a positive.
Like how when we got a dog, it was the excuse to leave places early because we had to go back to, you know, got to go home to April. Here she is.
And nowadays, that seems like a nothing excuse, right?
Yeah. We have way more excuses. That's like low, low, low on the list.
Exactly. So yeah, baby coming.
Yeah, we're accepting name recommendations for a boy.
Definitely.
All right.
My grandma's not doing such a good job with it.
It's not going well.
She suggested Victor.
It's not going well.
And Grayson.
And not just from her, but it's not going well.
All right.
We will, so we're going to do the holdovers.
The holidays are over. The depths of winter have yet to invade our souls. And that must mean one thing. It's Oscar season.
Yeah.
We're in awards season.
We are.
And we're watching awards movies. I'm Erin.
I'm Tom.
This is Baby's First Watch List, the podcast whose hosts are going through it right now.
I will say that the tagline for this movie is pretty emblematic of what we have going on right now.
Oh, really?
Discomfort and joy.
That's about right. So ignore any coughs that Tom can't edit out.
Yeah, I'm going to do my best here, people, but we're going to see.
Been sick all pregnancy so far.
We've been sick since like September, but yeah. You're like going through it, right? Like I'm fine right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got a lingering cough. I got the nausea, the this and the that. It's a blast. It's all good though, because today we're covering major awards contender, The Holdovers. So this 2023 comedy drama that's also not secretly, a Christmas movie. it was directed.
Was it marketed as one?
No.
But it is one.
It really is one.
Alexander Payne said he doesn't like the label, but I don't care.
Well, okay. Well, then don't make a movie during the Christmas season.
Don't make a Christmas movie, I don't know what to tell you. Idiot.
So it's directed by Alexander Payne, who's probably best known for, I would say, Election, Sideways, The Descendants, About Schmidt.
Yeah. Right. Nebraska.
Yeah. So
probably Election.
Election was like his first big one.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which Sideways. That's one that I haven't seen. And Sideways, it was a big hit.
He also did Downsizing, if you saw Downsizing.
No one did.
I'm just saying.
Sideways is kind of fun because the whole thing is like Paul Giamatti's character hates Merlot and sales for Merlot went like through the roof after.
Well, the whole thing in that movie, which we will do one day.
I loved that movie.
Is that like he's talking up about like how big of a wine snob he is, but he knows nothing about wine.
Yeah, it's genius.
It's he's just a pompous blowhard the entire movie.
Yeah, it's real good.
Yeah, like he is in this movie for a lot of it.
Yeah. So Alexander Payne was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay for Election at the Oscars, and he won for Best Adapted Screenplay for two of his movies, Sideways, and The Descendants.
Which, what's the fun fact about The Descendants?
Jim Rash, a.k.a. the Dean from Community, also won for Best Adapted Screenplay for The
Descendants. Oscar winner, the Dean from Community, Dean Pelton. What's Dean got to do with it?
What he probably is best known for there is he did, you know, so Angelina Jolie on the red carpet had that dress, the leg dress. And so when Jim Rash won, he stuck his leg out like Angelina Jolie did on the red carpet.
Jim Rash,
which is
man.
So good.
What a guy. And Nat Faxon's the other guy, right? The guy who's his like writing partner.
Who?
Nat Faxon.
Okay. You're probably right.
I am right. He co-directed The Way, Way Back with Jim Rash.
Interesting. Cool.
It was a fun movie.
I liked that movie. That was a good movie. That's one that I forgot about. So Alexander Payne was also nominated for Best Director for those two, Sideways and The Descendants, as well as the wonderful Nebraska.
Yeah.
Nebraska.
Black and White.
Was in Black and White.
Bruce Dern, Will Forte.
Yep. June Squibb.
June Squibb. Going,
my queen.
Going absolutely ham. Going way, way further than anybody needs to go. Going Saltburn levels of far.
Literally.
Literally.
Actually.
Literally
it's
Saltburn.
It's actually very close.
It's just very close to Saltburn levels of far in that movie. We're talking Squibb. About the grave, not the bathtub. And that will be the final reference to Saltburn on this podcast.
Probably not. Probably not. So we just watched it yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's a movie that doesn't leave your head right away.
Not right away.
So
maybe soon.
We might be talking about it. So I didn't realize that Alexander Payne didn't write this one.
Oh, he didn't? I didn't even realize. Mm-hmm. I got to rework like everything I talk about here. All my notes.
This movie was written by David Hemmingson. So he actually wrote on a lot of TV shows.
Oh, I know who that guy is. This was his first script, actually. I actually did read that. What am I talking about?
You're right. He wrote on Blackish, American Dad, Just Shoot Me, and many, many others. This is his first film screenplay that was made into a movie.
Yeah, his first feature. He also executive produced Kitchen Confidential.
Yes, he did. And he his first writing credits were for two episodes of... on Wikipedia, for two adventures of The Adventures of Pete and Pete, two episodes, sorry. And I loved that movie. I loved that show, but it also weirded me out. So the part that weirded me out was like the mom has a plate in her head.
Okay.
But they make it seem like it's like a real plate in her head.
Like a dish?
Like instead of a brain, she's a plate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so that freaked me out.
That is a little freaky. I would not like that if that were me.
Danny Tamborelli's in it.
Oh, good. A legend.
And Michelle Trachtenberg.
Lori Beth Denberg.
She might have actually appearances in there. I'm not going to say she didn't because I'm not sure. So yeah, he did two of those episodes.
We're big Lori Beth heads on this podcast, I guess.
What's not to like? Have you ever seen
Dodgeball?
Dodgeball? Come on. So the cinematographer, Eichel Brild, which I don't think I got that right.
Apologize.
Yeah. He also shot No Hard Feelings this past year,
okay,
which is a Jennifer Lawrence comedy. She's nominated for the Golden Globe for it. And he also shot In Bruges.
Mm.
And
very varied
even
catalog.
More interesting, won an Emmy for a cinematography work on the pilot episode of House of Cards.
Huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robin Wright led House of Cards.
Only Robin Wright led. Yes. Amazing. Editor Kevin Trent, he has edited every single one of Alexander Payne's movies.
Oh, wow.
To date.
I know that Payne has the same cinematographer he uses for all his movies, but not for this one, and I think not for The Descendants.
Okay.
There's two of them that he wasn't. His name's like Fedon Papa Michael or something like that. It's like something Greek.
Interesting. And Kevin Trent here, he was nominated for The Descendants for editing it.
Hmm.
The music was by Mark Orton. Previously Oscar nominated for his Nebraska score.
Mm.
So clearly
Payne likes to keep it in the family.
He does. And they, you know what? All of his movies that I have seen, I've seen now four of them. They all do contain a similar vibe, despite being in different time periods and different places. They're all in different places.
Some shot in color, some not shot in
color. Yeah, it's really interesting. So starring Paul Giamatti, Divine Joy Randolph, and Dominic Sessa in his first film role.
Wild.
The Holdovers was filmed in Massachusetts over, you know.
Oh, I was right.
Yeah.
You asked me during the movie. I was like, I think Massachusetts.
Well,
it was on location. Like, the Boston scenes are in Boston.
Right. And they did it at they had a couple of different, like, boys' schools that they looked at or private schools. And that's where they found Dominic Sessa. He actually had graduated in 2022 from, I think, Deerfield School, it was called. Yeah. And they had a couple people audition if you were interested, and he got the role from that, which I think is like so cool.
Yeah.
I love stuff. Like I think of Rachel Zegler doing West Side Story for her high school and then getting this part, like getting West Side Story. Like, it's amazing.
Giamatti claims to have found Sessa.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He says that he was the one who brought him on board. I don't know if it's true or not. Ah. But what I read was that it said Giamatti claims that he found Dominic Sessa.
Do you know, Paul Giamatti is younger than my parents.
It's crazy. Paul Giamatti looks old sometimes.
Because I know that my parents are going to listen to this episode. He is younger than you.
It's it's the vibe that he gives off, too. Like, he feels older because he always plays, like, these neurotic, like,
he
balding,
played John Adams, like, decades
20
ago.
20 years ago, yeah.
Like, what the heck?
Yeah. Well, John Adams didn't live to be that old.
I guess not, but I always think of them as ancient.
Yeah. How old did John Adams live to be?
Yeah, let's see.
How old? Are they not going to give me a number here? I can't do this math. When did he die? It's like never mind. He did live a long time. He died at 90. Okay, well, I'm gonna take back what I just said.
Well, I just think about Giamatti and like Big Fat Liar, and I guess he was young then, but he looked so old to me when I was
like 10.
Big
Fat Liar was 02. Oh, yeah. Same guy who directed Free Guy.
So he was like close to how old we are.
2002.
Now. Just a little bit old.
He was 35. which is only a couple years older than us.
Oh my gosh.
But it's the fact that he's balding. Like that he's been balding since he was in his 30s. And he never embraced going bald, like doing full bald.
Yeah, he goes.
You don't need to, but like if he had embraced being full bald, like that's a different look than balding.
Right, of course.
You know, so he just has always looked older.
Yeah. He's still my king.
I don't say this only because I'm approaching 35.
It's so funny.
It's definitely not just because of me.
So this movie took place in 1970, and Alexander Payne had said that it wasn't as hard as you'd think to film in like it was a period piece. I think he said something about how New England moves slowly or changes slowly.
It does feel like it's like when we visited Newport and Boston and like those areas, there are suburban areas that look like they're in the 80s still.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that extremely charming.
Yeah.
But I totally see where he's coming from with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's hard when we live in such a, you know, the area in the world that is so advanced.
New Jersey.
State of New Jersey.
Yes.
Then everything looks like it's going at a snail's pace compared to us.
Exactly. I mean, I can't disagree.
So, The Holdovers was released a few months back in like late October, which is kind of interesting. You would have thought it would be maybe a late November release.
Especially given the fact that it takes place at Christmas and the fact that it's like an Oscar movie.
Exactly. So, it didn't say on Wikipedia how much it cost to make, but it made $19.9 million, and it gained a lot of critical acclaim. So far, it's been nominated for 3 Golden Globes, which will, by the time this comes out, we'll know if it won any, right?
Are the Globes tomorrow?
I think the Globes are tomorrow, aren't they?
Already? Yeah, they're the 7th. We're recording this on the 6th.
So we will probably see Divine Joy Randolph win?
Yes.
Would be my guess.
Oh, I forgot there's TV shows. It says most nominations, Barbie and Succession. I was like, wait a minute.
My question to you, Tom, is Paul Giamatti, is he nominated for comedy or for
I'm sure drama? Comedy, but I will double check you.
It's also, so far, nominated for 8 Critics' Choice Awards and 4 Independent Spirit Awards.
He is nominated for musical or comedy. Best performance in a motion picture, musical or comedy.
It's always interesting how the Globes choose it.
Yeah.
He
cracked me up this entire movie.
I know, but it's not funny. But it's funny.
A lot of it is funny.
I know, but
there are very funny moments in this movie.
I agree, but it's funny, like a drama funny.
Like, they have American Fiction in here, and I don't know. We haven't seen
as
American
comedy?
Fiction yet, but it's under comedy or musical.
Okay.
I think because it's like a satire, but I don't think it's going to, I don't think it's like funny, like, funny. Right.
So, the Holdover.
But, hold on. I'm sorry. But also, Barry Keoghan is nominated for Saltburn in under drama, which.
But I would consider that more of a comedy.
Yeah. That's strange.
The Holdovers is expected to get quite a few Oscar nominations. I would say that out of all of those, Best Supporting Actress seems to be the biggest lock.
And I think that Best Original Screenplay is inching closer to being a lock.
Yeah,
because
Barbie, the Academy decided, has to be an adapted screenplay.
Which?
As opposed to original.
It's weird because I can see the argument for both sides.
What is the argument?
Barbie has been campaigning for original.
Which makes sense to me if I had to choose.
Me too. But I think the idea on it being adapted, I think there's two things. One, I think they're saying that it's being adapted from an intellectual property that is like kind of already established as... Like, you can't make Barbie without knowing what a baseline Barbie is, adapting it from what a Barbie is, like what mm-hmm. what the attitudes towards Barbie are, okay. what the sort of conceptions about Barbie are. You can't subvert an expectation unless you have an expectation. But on the other hand, you could say that about any biopic.
I was just about to say, what about a famous person?
Every biopic is the same concept.
Right.
Like if you didn't base it off a book, like for example, Maestro is not based on a book. It's not based on anything. It's just based on the life of Leonard Bernstein and how the, Bradley Cooper and his co-writer or whoever sort of conceived Leonard Bernstein on film. That is up for, or that's going to be up for original screenplay.
Really?
So to me, that means the common denominator is the intellectual property. So if you're basing something off an intellectual property, it's adapted. If you're basing something off of a person, a real person, it's original. And I don't know why that is. Unless it's based on a biography of that person.
Yeah, of course. I just wonder why something like that, they're going to tell Barbie, like, no, you're going in adapted, when you have things like Lily Gladstone. It seems to be on a, like, if she's supporting or if she's lead, and they get to choose what they submit her in.
My guess would be because...
I guess they could still nominate her in the other one if they wanted to, right?
Yeah. The Academy can kind of do whatever it wants, I think. I don't know, like, its bylaws or anything like that, but that's the impression I get. And also, the thing that sort of persuaded me for Barbie being an adapted, which I don't agree with on a conceptual level, but I agree with on a precedent level, because they made the Lego movie submit for adapted.
Okay.
And I think that there's more of a... The Lego movie wasn't based on any, like, there's no,
there
like,
just Legos,
Legos don't have like a thing, don't have lore, don't have whatever. Like, if you're going to make Legos be adapted and not original, then you have to make Barbie be adapted.
Okay, that's fair.
I don't necessarily agree with it, but given what they have done in the past, I can see why they had to put Barbie in adapted.
I understand that now that you used the other one.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with the concept, but I think that's what they're doing.
Yeah. All right, that's fair. Okay, so before we get to your little synopsis, which you said you're going to do short.
Yeah, I'm done with the big plot summaries.
I agree. I think that's a good idea.
Nobody wants to hear me talk.
I mean, I love hearing you talk.
Everyone listening to this podcast does to some degree, I guess.
I mean,
so
yeah,
thank you.
I guess so, right?
But not a lot.
No. So, okay, I'm going to do my New Jersey connection then before you do that.
Do it.
Okay. Now that we don't have our guests, I can actually sing the song again.
I know, you were going
to not be embarrassed about it.
And, but it's funny because they listened to our other
episodes. Yeah,
episode,
I'm
so
sure they were waiting with bated breath for me to sing, but they were left disappointed. All right, ready? Get connected for free. Free. Your New Jersey connection. I have some really, like, I have probably the best New Jersey connection yet.
Yeah.
If you look on Wikipedia at the holdovers, you will see that only 6 of the actors listed have Wikipedia pages. Now, if you click through those 6, one of them, Paul Giamatti, he, Nepo baby.
Is he really?
Well, remember his dad was the
president
of Yale and one of the commissioners of the Major League Baseball.
Right, right.
What the heck?
Yeah, people forget. Nepo babies don't just mean like, oh, your dad was an actor. Like, no, your dad was the president of Yale. You were a Nepo baby. Sorry,
I was shocked.
Paul, if you're listening, we love you. You're a Nepo baby.
And that's okay.
Yes. Oh, yeah, we're pro Nepo baby, by the way. We're at least not anti-Nepo baby.
Wait. So, he, of course, was born in New Haven, Connecticut.
Yeah, duh.
Which is pretty close to New Jersey. Not
Tri-state
bad.
Area.
Tri-state area. Carrie Preston, who played Lydia Crane, who Paul Giamatti's character had a little crush on.
Yeah.
She was from Macon, Georgia. Okay.
Okay.
Well, Divine Joy Randolph, she, who played Mary Lamb, and she's a future Oscar winner over the next couple months.
Yep.
She, most likely, she was born in Philadelphia and raised in Philly and Hershey, Pennsylvania. We, of course, are a mere half an hour, 40 minutes from Philly. So she is New Jersey adjacent.
Right.
If we look at our last three here, so that's the first three. One is like pretty close to New Jersey. Our last three, we've got Dominic Sessa.
Yes.
We have Jillian Vigman, who played the mom, Dominic's mom.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Tate Donovan.
Tate Donovan, the god.
Of OC fame, who plays Angus's stepfather. All three are from New Jersey.
There you go.
Tate Donovan.
That's how you know that they're a family that fits together on screen.
That's right.
Because they're all from the great state.
From New Jersey.
The Garden State.
So Tate Donovan, Hercules himself, he's from Tenafly, which
up
is
north.
North Jersey.
Yeah. We are closer, much closer to Philadelphia than we are to Tenafly.
Yes. Jillian Vigman is from Morristown, New Jersey.
Up north. Morris, not Moores.
Morris, okay. North. And Dominic Sessa is actually from Cherry Hill.
Which is like 30 minutes from us.
Yeah, which is so cool. One of our friends just moved there.
Yeah.
So that is your New Jersey connection. I am like so happy with it. You could not have The Holdovers without New Jersey.
Yeah. Just like every other movie, but especially The Holdovers.
Oh, yeah. No. Every movie. Especially
including
all of the ones.
Roman Holiday, Tampopo. Yeah.
All the ones that were really hard to find connections to.
Yes. And were like weak connections. Wally. Hello, Dolly wouldn't have been the same without New Jersey.
That was not a good one. All right. So you got connected for free.
For free.
Give us our plot synopsis.
All right. So we are, as Aaron mentioned, we're in the early 1970s. I think it's 70.
We're in 1970.
70 into 71, right? Mm-hmm. So 1970, we're at the Barton School for Boys or whatever.
Boys Don't Lie.
Barton Boys Don't Lie in Massachusetts somewhere.
Yep.
And nobody likes teacher Paul Hunnam at all, played by Paul Giamatti. Not his students, not his fellow faculty, not the headmaster, who all find his pomposity and rigidity exasperating. He's like saying all this like weird stuff, over the top academic stuff, and he's refusing to like give kids grades because their parents are donors, which like cool, good for you, Paul. With no family and nowhere to go over Christmas holiday in 1970, Paul kind of gets railroaded into remaining at school to supervise students who are unable to go home for one reason or another. So there's a whole group of them, but then one of their dads comes in a helicopter and sort of picks everybody up to go skiing except for one kid, a troublemaking 15-year-old, LOL at him being 15, named Angus, played by Dominic Sessa, a good student whose bad behavior always threatens to get him expelled. Joining Paul and Angus is head cook Mary, played by Divine Joy Randolph, a black woman who caters to sons of privilege and whose own son was recently lost in Vietnam. These three very different shipwrecked people form an unlikely Christmas family sharing comic misadventures during two very snowy weeks in New England. And the journey is how they help one another understand that they are not beholden to their past and they can choose their own futures. They take a trip to Boston. This is now no longer part of my like plot synopsis. They take a trip to Boston. Mary visits her family and sort of like starts to heal her wounds.
Mm-hmm.
Angus and Paul sort of get into little arguments and spats, and they sort of are like testing each other and sort of figuring out where each of them lies. And by the end, Paul sticks his neck out for Angus and helps him not get expelled, and Paul gets fired. And then they have
spoilers.
Huh?
Spoilers.
Yeah, exactly. And they kind of, you know, go their separate ways, but they have an acknowledgement with one another that, you know, they're good people.
Yeah. I loved this movie.
Me too.
Thought it was a really, really good one. So this really did make me feel like, oh, this is really like an Alexander Payne movie. So like I said, we have seen this one. We've seen Nebraska. We've seen The Descendants. And we've seen Sideways.
Yes.
I'm definitely interested in Election.
And about Schmidt.
I don't know.
Why?
Because I think that...
It's Jack.
Is Kathy Bates in it?
I think so.
All right, I'm in.
I actually have the tab up.
There's like a Kathy Bates like hot tub thing going on in About Schmidt.
We watched June Squibb do what she did in Nebraska.
Listen.
It's also got Hope Davis and Dermot Mulroney.
Oh, I mean, King and Queen.
We're in
right
on
there.
About Schmidt, baby.
All right. Yeah, I'll watch it. So...
And June Squibb's in that one, too.
Oh, okay. Never mind. I'm in. So one of the things that I'm going to ask you the question, what do you like about Alexander Payne movies the most? I'm going to answer it, though.
Okay.
So for me, what I like about all of them is I find that there's a sense of melancholy with the characters. Doesn't matter what movie it is. You have this kind of sadness that pervades through these different characters' lives and their thoughts and their emotions. So in Nebraska, for example, Will Forte is taking his dad, Bruce Dern, all the way to Nebraska because Bruce Dern is convinced that he won the lottery and has to go to, like, submit his ticket and whatever.
And everyone knows it's not.
And everyone knows it's, like, not real. And Will Forte does not. Right now, he's going through it in his own life. And, like, he just, like, has to do this with his dad. And it's, like, it's just not a good situation, right? So he's got this kind of, like, overarching sadness here. George Clooney is kind of in The Descendants going through it because his wife, who he found out was having an affair, right, is very ill.
She's dying.
She's dying, yeah. I think. And so he lives in Hawaii.
She's dying. Like, she's on a ventilator. Like, she's, like, in the hospital dying. Like, it's not like, oh, you know, there's no way to communicate with her.
Right. And so he has that kind of complex relationship. And even though he's living in paradise in Hawaii, he's dealing with that while also struggling raising his daughter.
Shailene Woodley?
Yep. And so she's also going through it.
Yep.
And I know that Sideways, I mean...
Everyone's messed up.
Everybody's messed up inside.
Thomas Hayden Church is like a serial cheater. Like,
yeah,
Giamatti.
So I love Giamatti.
Is just like his neurotic self.
Yeah. So even
Sandra
Oh
is wild in that movie.
Yeah, who he was married to for a couple years, Alexander Payne.
Yeah.
So I what I really
she's like a biker in that movie.
Yeah.
Or something.
What I really enjoy about his movies is the fact that people are living their lives through that kind of that kind of negative emotion. I feel like a lot of times people are either like, and this is in movies, like they're either really happy or really upset about something. And this kind of, all of his movies kind of land in the middle.
But what I like about it too, and I think is important to point out, is that the tones of the movies aren't extremely heavy. Typically.
Right, exactly.
Like, you hear those subject matters and you're like, oh my God, this is a slog. I don't want to watch it. It's so sad.
And they,
like,
never are.
You might find some of these movies, not The Holdovers, but you might find some of these movies sad. You might find Nebraska sad. You might find The Descendants sad. But I ultimately don't. Like, they're full of life and humor also.
All of them are considered comedies.
Yes. I wouldn't say that they're funny. I thought that this movie was very funny at times. But they're all humorous and they all have sort of ironic premises. And I think that he is really good at exploring those types of premises.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So that's what I like the most is these characters are experiencing difficult times and feeling and they're struggling, but they still are able to live their lives with humor. And
they're not crushed by the weight of it.
No. And living in a way that that kind of supersedes that, you know?
Yeah.
And it is kind of interesting. I was, for some reason, I was on the Manchester by the Sea Wikipedia page.
that movie does not treat anything with humor.
Well, and that's exactly it. I forget who it was. I think it was the director, Kenneth Lonergan. Yeah. I think it was him or somebody else, like in the making of the movie, who said that, like, he wanted to see a movie where, like, a man was, like, very overcome by grief.
Yeah.
And, like, unable to get through it. And unable
to... Well,
he
did that.
Yeah, I mean, that really worked. But I feel like Alexander Payne is able to do the opposite of that. And I find that to be kind of a more... an approach that I think more people can relate to.
Well, that's kind of what you get in this movie. You get the person who's grieving, for the most part, is Mary. And she's the one that's the most open and welcoming and who treats the other two like probably better than they should be treated mm-hmm. in the beginning parts of the movie.
Yep.
You can tell that she and Paul have a pre-existing friendship.
Right.
She like immediately gives him whiskey or whatever when he like walks over to her at the desk. So like they're like she's one of the few people at the school who actually likes him.
Right.
Or at least understand or at least understands who he is and where he's coming from. But I totally think that fits in with your theory that it's about people going through it, but it's about people who are moving through it,
right,
who are
exactly.
navigating and who are working and aren't paralyzed by grief, which there's nothing wrong with being paralyzed by grief either. But this is just a different approach than something like in Manchester by the Sea.
Exactly. So what's your favorite thing about Alexander Payne movies or what do you like about
them? Well, I'm going to co-sign everything you said because I totally agree. But I also wrote down while we were watching the movie, I wrote that there's a sequence in every Payne movie I've seen that just gives me chills. And in this one, it was the entire set of scenes from when they get to Mary's house So they get to Mary's house. Angus like brings her upstairs, like helps her up the stairs, like a nice boy helps her up the stairs. And she goes and she talks with her family, but you don't get to see what they're talking about. Like you just see them hanging out in, I don't know if it was her childhood bedroom or her son's room. And it was like her and I guess her sister or something. Yes. And they were just sitting on the bed, like cracking up with each other while there was like a movie score playing over it. Like you don't get to hear what they're saying. It's just sort of like a family sharing a family moment. So you get that. Then you get Paul and Angus at the bookstore outside when the lady comes up to Paul and asks him something.
About some services, yes.
About some services. And he says no after Angus tries to sort of egg him on into doing it.
Yeah.
But then they have like a whole big talk about like they go to the museum and Paul has this great quote. I'm just looking it up real quick. He says... They're standing in the museum, and it's all these like ancient artifacts. So Paul is a teacher of ancient history, like classical history, and he says to Angus, "There's nothing new in human experience, Mr. Tully. Every generation thinks it invented debauchery or suffering or rebellion, but man's every impulse and appetite, from the disgusting to the sublime, is on display right here, all around you. So, before you dismiss something as boring or irrelevant, remember." If you truly want to understand the present or yourself, you must begin in the past. You see, history is not simply the study of the past. It is an explanation of the present.
Yeah.
Which I think is one of the thesis statements of the movie.
Yes.
It's the fact that these people who are dragging all this trauma with them, it explains who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the past explains the present. Mary's son dying in Vietnam explains why she's in the state that she's in. Paul's sort of... He has certain conditions. Like, he, like, smells like fish. Like, he has, like, all these, like... He's very buttoned up and afraid to sort of embrace life and what life means. Because he has something that happened in his past where he got kicked out of school for allegedly... Was it, like, forging a paper or something like that?
No.
That he took the fall for somebody. Yeah.
And so he ended up hitting the roommate with this car.
That's what it was. On accident, he says.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well...
And then Angus has a situation going on with his dad, who was in a mental institution, who had suddenly he had an onset of something, some sort of mental illness. And he really doesn't like how his mom moved on pretty quickly and is with a stepfather that he doesn't really like. Mm-hmm. So we learn all of this throughout the movie, and it helps us sort of look backwards at these people. It's almost the opposite of the museum scene, because it's like we're looking at them in the present as we learn about their past.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's...
But when you learn about their past, that helps you understand who they are in the present.
The past is an explanation of the present.
And be more sympathetic towards who they are. Like, Mary has this great line that I'm not going to be able to say verbatim. But, like...
There's many lines in this movie that we're not going to be able to say.
Well, no, not because it's bad or anything.
Oh.
But, Paul...
Oh, I know exactly which one you're talking about.
She said, like, you can't have big dreams.
I got it. I actually wrote it down.
Which, that really stood out to me.
Where is it?
Paul is, like, unable to really expand. Paul
wants to write a book.
Yes.
But he calls it a monograph.
Yes.
Because a monograph is, like, a short book. And it's him, Angus, and he's talking to Mary, and, like, Angus is in the background, and he's not really in the conversation, but he just goes, why not just write a book? And Paul goes, I'm not sure I have an entire book in me. And Mary just looks at him and goes, you can't even dream a whole dream, can you?
I thought that was
my favorite.
Wow.
That's my favorite line in the whole movie.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, seriously, like, as somebody, I don't know how much I've talked about it at length on the podcast, but, like, I'm trying to write a screenplay. I will eventually get one done. And that's a line that hits me, because it's like, so many people write garbage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, I could get something done.
Yeah,
of course. I just have to do it. I have to dream the whole dream.
Yeah, of course.
I do have a whole book in me somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, as you know, to paraphrase Paul.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a line that I think, again, is sort of emblematic of the entire movie.
And lines like that, I think, are what really take this from something that I know, like, my sister said that, like, she didn't feel like this movie did anything. And I don't think she meant this as a criticism, but she didn't feel like this did anything new.
Well, I think she meant that in a plot kind of way.
And
I totally agree with that. This movie is a throwback But it's, I think it's a well done throwback.
Yeah. And I think that lines like that and with Paul and Angus in the museum are what really elevates this, along with the performances, of course.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's, everything's well done.
Paul, I can't say a lot of Paul, especially Paul's lines.
Yeah.
But he has so many great like quips and one liners in this movie too.
Yes. That's awesome. So let's talk about more about the movie itself. What is your favorite thing about this movie?
I love that it's a Christmas movie that sort of expounds on the spirit of Christmas and like what you want from a Christmas movie. You want people coming together. It encapsulates the spirit of Christmas, but it's not cloying and it's not saccharine and like over melodramatic. Mm-hmm. It's I find that Payne's movies really reflect sort of the realities of emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I think that this movie really, really did that. I mean, all three of the main characters, you can see the emotion bleeding out of them. I mean, Paul Giamatti, you know, like, but he's at all of these big words he's using and the fact that he's yelling at the kids, like, it's from scene one, you can see it's a defense mechanism, but it's about why is it a defense mechanism? What is he defending himself from? And the bottom line is he's afraid to embrace his future. He's afraid to, I mean, he went to Barton. So, I mean, he refuses to leave his past behind until the end when he finally makes the choice, which gets him fired. He basically says like, to Angus's step parents, who his mom and his stepdad, who found out that Paul brought him to his dad at the institution. Paul basically took the fall for it. Because it was Angus's idea, but Paul said it was totally his idea and he wanted to do it and all that. So he kept Angus in school and Paul left. So that choice, which the choice is important. If he had just been fired.
Well, and that's something that he didn't get the choice when he was in college.
Right.
And now he does have that choice.
Right. He knew that he was risking his job, that he would get fired. And especially because of what he said to the headmaster on the way out, who was his. I'm actually going to say it because I don't care. I can bleep it out, but I'm going to say it because I wrote it down. He's walking out of the room after he talks to Angus's mom and stepdad. The headmaster at the school's name was Hardy, and he was a student when Paul like had
started.
His first year teacher, and he hated him. And Paul, as he's leaving the office, goes, Hardy, I have known you since you were a boy, so I think I have the requisite experience and insight to aver that you are and always have been cancer in human form.
Yeah.
Like, it's so good.
Yeah, that's so, oh my God.
It's so good. But like Giamatti in this movie is just, he's wild.
He is wild. I think my favorite thing about this movie, it comes down to the characterization for me and the fact that I feel like this is very emblematic of the human experiences we interact with other people. So when you start watching it, you see these people for just the generalizations
archetypes
of how people see them, right? Paul is this like hard teacher that it like everyone's like, oh, he's so annoying, whatever. Angus, at first you think he's being bullied and then you realize no, he's actually like really mean.
Literally the first scene he's like in his room like brushing his teeth or whatever, and the one of his friends comes in who you see like throughout the first act of the movie, and he's like I forget exactly what he said, but he was like approaching him in like an antagonistic way, and then Angus just completely turns it on his head. And like,
yeah.
It's like when you throw the jab and you get hit with the haymaker.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
And so you're like, oh, he's one of those bad kids, whatever. Yeah. And then Mary, you just see her as like, oh, she's
overworked.
An overworked woman who is like just a grieving mom, yeah. Right? That's all you see. And so you kind of see that kind of those archetypes only. Just like the kid that Angus was talking to,
yeah.
His classmate, who Angus and him kind of bully each other. And this kid is like not nice at all.
No.
And you see him as like one of those like, oh, classmate bullies. Because you know Angus is going to be one of the main characters, yeah. Right? So the other kid, you're like, oh, he's like a bully.
The other kid is the kid whose dad comes to pick them up and bring them skiing.
No, it's not.
It's not?
Nope. That's the kid who had the nice flow.
Oh, the football guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sorry.
So... what I like about this movie is that we sort of get those insights later on that makes us feel like we're their friends. And it's kind of like one of those things where like when you have a friend that's like really quirky or has things about them that other people might not see. And you say like, no, you don't get it. That's like not who they really are.
Yeah.
Right. But then if there's people that you don't get that insight into, like that bully kid.
Yeah.
We never find out why he's being held over Christmas break. We never find out the pain that he's clearly going through.
That he's taking on other people.
He's taking it out on other people. We don't ever find that out.
Which is exactly what Angus is doing too.
Exactly. And so I really love that like we see that example of like we could probably in some other universe find out what's really going on with him and then he would be more sympathetic to us. But just like in real life, we don't get that experience with a lot of people. And so he kind of goes off. Right. But with the others, we really get into that insight and we end up really understanding them. And I think that that's like really true with people that you end up developing relationships with.
The thing that I love about that, too, which I told you earlier that I sort of observed was that it's by the end of the movie. What I find in a lot of these types of movies is that the character that you see at the end is totally different from the character that they were in the beginning. You don't get that in this movie.
No, they're the same.
You get that Paul, Mary, and Angus have all had these moments of change, of course, and acceptance, and whatever you want to call it. But to the outside world, to that kid, like Angus is still kind of a smartass, and you know people are happy that Paul got fired because they didn't like him. But it's a secret between the viewer and Paul and Mary and Angus that like Angus and Paul aren't that bad. They're good people. They're good people under the sort of layers and layers and layers of defense that they're putting up and armor that they are either afraid to sort of share with everyone else or they're afraid they'll get picked on or bullied or like Angus going back at that guy, at that kid is like he doesn't want to get bullied. So he's going to bully 10 times as hard. But then you see what he did with the one kid who like peed the bed.
Right.
And he was like really nice to him and he was helpful and nobody ever found out that the kid peed the bed and he was like mortified. You know he's a good kid.
Right.
And that's why it's very Blake Snyder who wrote the one book that I, screenwriting book that I've read, Save the Cat. It's like one of the most famous screenwriting books. And one of his theories is that if you have a character who's unlikable, you want to see them do something early on that makes you sort of want to see them succeed. For example, if you have Tony Soprano in your script, you want to see him save a cat, pull a cat out of a tree, you know, like that sort of thing. So you can be like, okay, I know that under all of this,
there's something there.
And that's sort of what you get with Angus in that scene.
Well, and that's something that Mary really emphasizes throughout the movie is she says to so many different people, like they're kids.
Yeah.
These boys are kids. They're still figuring. And it's like, as a teacher of 13-year-olds, I have to remind myself that all the time. Like when they say something that is callous, if they're bullying somebody, if they're going through it and they're really talking back, whatever, they're kids. Like they are probably dealing with something and you got to just like take a step back and know that like there's other stuff going on in it just because they have a bad moment. Or a few bad moments, or a lot of bad moments, like our characters do, that doesn't necessarily mean anything about them, their characters, right?
Or the characters, their generation. Like, I have that whole big pet peeve where I actually wrote it down. I said, this movie reminds me why I hate the generational kids these days comments, because kids always have been and always probably will be generally the same.
Yes.
Like, it's just a human development. Like,
yep.
They complain. They do dumb stuff. They do stuff that you would never do. They do stuff that you think you never would have done back then, but
you probably
would have.
Yeah.
They don't listen. Like, so did we. We don't listen. Adults don't listen. Like, that's how people grow. We all have the same general problems. Like, it's not like just because they're younger and they do things differently than you that they're worse than you.
Mm-hmm.
Or that they're going to grow up to be worse than you.
Right.
Because they're probably not. Like, this has been going on since the beginning of time. Like, you heard it with millennials, but you hear it going back. There's newspaper clippings from, like, the 1910s being like, you know, this new generation, this newfangled whatever, refuses to work in the mines when they're 8 years old. Like, it's all generational perception. And I hate when people, like, deride an entire generation based on the actions of, you know, even if it's one bad apple or not even a bad apple, just something that you just don't understand anymore.
Well, and they say that in the holdovers when Paul is teaching very old school, and the guy, the headmaster, is like, well, kids these days are different. You need to adjust to that.
Yeah.
Well, they're not different.
I had that quote too.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Yeah, wow, look at that. We're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, I don't know where it is, but I'll find it. If I find it, I'll say it.
Awesome. So let me see what else I got here. I mean, I have my only other questions on like Oscar season watching so far. So let's go to your questions and then we can kind of.
Yeah, we'll wrap up with that.
Yeah.
Okay. I have a couple. Does this hit like your general like list of favorite Christmas movies?
I think it very well could. It's a different kind of Christmas movie than like a lot of the ones that I watch are goofier.
Yeah.
This isn't goofy.
This is in the realm of like It's a Wonderful Life.
Exactly. But it certainly is one of the Christmas movies that have stuck out to me the most over the past few years.
Yeah, I totally agree. I could see myself rewatching this a lot.
Oh, definitely.
On Christmas, over Christmas and all that. It's slightly long, like a little over 2 hours.
It's a little long.
Like if I'm going to sit down and watch a Christmas movie that I want to sort of breeze by, it's probably not going to be this one. But I definitely think I would add it to like my, if I'm making a list, checking it twice of my favorite Christmas movies.
It's on there.
It's I would say firmly in the top 10.
Oh, yeah.
With room to grow.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it will be conducive to multiple watches too.
Definitely.
What else? What are your thoughts on the production and costume design? Because that's a big standout in this movie that we haven't really talked about.
Yeah, I thought it was like really, really, really lovely. 1970 is a great year for costumes.
Clearly.
And
they got,
I
like sweaters going on. They got the whole deal.
I actually noted in my head that like I thought that Divine Joy Randolph had really lovely costumes throughout the movie. She looked great.
Shout out to Wendy Chuck.
She looked amazing. And she a lot of times like when she would pick her own outfits, not wear the uniform at the school, she chose these like lovely jewel tones that I think kind of show you that like that. Little bit of spark, you know, even though she's a woman going through grief, there's something there.
And dude, Giamatti with the bow ties.
I mean, that's to be expected.
At the Christmas party, which we'll get into this. At the Christmas party, who has the most game? So each of our three characters is trying to talk a little bit with one of the other characters. So obviously, if we're talking about our main three, the list of who has the most game goes from Mary to Angus to a giant gap to just a whole chasm to Paul. Paul is
DOA.
Struggling out there. But the people that they are talking to, so we have Danny, who was the man that, is he the janitor?
I think so.
He's the janitor at the school that that Mary talks to and strikes up a little.
He loves Mary.
He's in love with Mary. Lydia Crane, who is one of the other teachers at the school that Paul Giamatti's sort of spitting some game at.
Yeah, but you find out she's not interested. She's nice.
She's not. I wrote this before that reveal.
Yeah.
And Elisa, who is Lydia's niece or something, who is the girl that Angus smooches a little bit.
Yeah.
And so who of those three has the most game and who has the least?
Danny, 7 days a week and twice on Sunday. Yeah. No doubt about it. He buys Mary a beautiful little Christmas present. It's like, I think, a brooch.
Yeah.
It's like,
he's a sweet guy. He spends New Year's with them.
Mm-hmm. And you could tell he's just a smooth fella.
He's smitten.
And even when Mary has a moment where she is frustrated and angry and whatever, he is there and isn't getting kind of scared off.
Not at all.
And I think that's really, it shows. He doesn't just have the riz, but he also cares.
But Paul, no riz whatsoever. Lydia.
Paul is rizless.
I'm going to discount Lydia from this question because it's not actually flirting.
Yeah. No.
So we'll take Lydia out.
I think it's Elise. I don't think it's Elisa.
Oh, I wrote Elisa. So
I'm not sure.
Elisa. She like brings Angus down into the basement where like all the kids are doing like crafts and stuff. Mm-hmm. And she said that she kind of grew up there and was doing all that stuff down there. And then, like, she's just very, like, awkward and stilted. But
teenage girl.
Yeah. But she gets the job done, you know? And then he gets pulled away because that's when Mary's crying and all that.
Right.
Yeah. So, I agree. I think it's Danny. Danny's
gotta
the best.
Be Danny.
Danny is, like, low-key one of the heart.
He's a great character.
He's a great character.
Very good supporting role.
Do you have a favorite Giamattiism from this movie? Because I wrote down a few, but I've said a lot of them.
There's so many.
All right. Again, I'm going to bleep this one out. His big quote from the movie, he's talking to the kid who is like kind of the bully, and he says, "Life is a hen house ladder," in short.
Yeah.
And because he's like defending Mary, because the kid is like mean to Mary because he's an ASS. But... Mm-hmm. Do I have anything else? My only other one. Oh, I have two more. Paul says, "Fresh air would do you good." And Angus says, "It's like 15 degrees outside." And Paul goes, "And the Romans bathed naked in the freezing Tiber. Adversity builds character."
So good.
It's like, why? Like, who makes that reference?
He makes a lot of references like that.
Well, remember, my other one here is when they go to the restaurant and the restaurant refuses to give Angus, what was it?
Miller High Life. Champagne of beers.
But it wasn't there something in like a dessert that they refused to give him?
Oh, at the fancy restaurant.
At the fancy restaurant.
Cherry's Jubilee.
Oh, they don't, yeah.
Because there's brandy in it.
So they won't give him Cherry's Jubilee.
Even though, as Mary proves that she is a very good cook, she says, "Doesn't the alcohol burn off?"
Yeah.
And it does, so.
Yeah. And the waiter was like, the waitress was like, "I don't know what you want me to tell you. Like, that's
yeah,
my, I just
she
can't."
She wasn't very, yeah.
Paul goes, "Okay, I'll get the Cherry's Jubilee." And they're like, she's like, "No, you can't do that." And Paul says, "What kind of fascist hash foundry are you running here?" It's so just good. Like the most obnoxious lines.
He's so good.
He's the best.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti killed it.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, the other ones that I said earlier.
Yes.
Are all. This is all the
you're going to be doing a lot of bleeping this episode.
Oh, yeah. This is the Mount Rushmore of Giamatti.
Yeah, love it.
That's it. That's all my questions. The only other question I have, we sort of already answered, so we can...
Great. So let's talk about our Oscar season watching so far.
Wait, do you want me to do... I looked up a little bit about the production design, if you want me to
do
that first, and then we'll come back at the end. So it's a Focus Features article, and it's called "How Alexander Payne's The Holdovers Championed 70s Scenery," and it was a Q&A with the production designer, Ryan Warren Smith. Giamatti said in the production notes, "One of the things I love about Alexander's movies is the sense of place in each one of them. To bring this world alive, Payne brought on production designer Ryan Warren Smith, who has excelled in capturing real American landscapes in TV shows like True Detective. IndieWire wrote that of his ultra-convincing production design, the vibes are immaculate from the start and only grow more so as the characters gradually start to become as detailed as the world that The Holdovers constructs around them." And so he's talking about how they shot everything on location rather than a soundstage. And he said that Alexander is such an open individual that he doesn't want to control all aspects of the production. He wanted the real world to be part of the story, which I think is great.
Yeah.
He said often Alexander would cast people who lived in the locations. Mm-hmm. So like I know a lot of the bartender. Remember when he's at the bar and he's talking to the guy in the Santa suit and he's explaining why it's not the like
real
historically
Santa,
correct
yeah.
Santa suit.
Yeah.
The guy at the bar, the bartender, is the real bartender at that bar.
Fun.
So like Alexander Payne likes to do that.
It's very safty of him.
Yeah. And so the, you know, Ryan Warren Smith said, "This is part of Alexander's philosophy of filmmaking, to let real life breathe into the production. It is something that you can feel in the film." And I totally, totally, totally agree with
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
They asked him, "What does Paul's office say about him?" And Smith said, "I think it tells us that he's stuck. His office is pretty cluttered. There are things there that look like they've been there for weeks, maybe months. He has socks drying on the radiator. All those little things add up to tell us that Paul is stuck in his life, that there are all these things that he has started and never finished." And I think that that is a perfect example of how people who just like look at a plot and say, this is what this is. I feel like a lot of times people don't realize like the little things around you that you're not even like consciously, like I didn't notice that.
Mm-hmm.
But now that they said it, it's like, it's of course, it like makes sense. I can picture his office in my head. It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, of course it looks like it's, he's stuffed up. It's a total mess. And then the only time it looks good is when he's leaving.
Right.
That's the only time you ever see any light in his office. And apparently there was also an Easter egg in his office. There's a piece of set dressing that was in the apartment of his character in Sideways. Paul brought it to set, and Alexander thought we should put it in. And there's also a scene where Mary is pulling up to her sister's house, and the two storefronts in front of the building are named after Alexander's kids and Smith's kids.
Nice.
Yeah. So it was a cool little like Q&A type thing with the production designer. And then I'll just do a little bit of trivia. I did find five trivias. So Focus Features bought worldwide rights for the film for $30 million after it was screened at the Toronto International Film Festival. It's the biggest sale ever to happen at the festival, despite it not even being on the roster that year.
Wow.
It didn't actually play at the festival. Like as a big thing. Divine Joy Randolph, who's a non-smoker, Mary smokes a lot in this movie.
Yeah, she does.
She found that smoking fake cigarettes looked unrealistic, so she smoked real cigarettes for this movie.
Wow.
She said she was very sensitive to not becoming addicted, and she decided on American Spirit as the brand she disliked the most and could quit easily after after filming wrapped. Number three, in a 2023 interview with the Associated Press, Alexander Payne spoke about the films he screened for the crew for inspiration. In the Somerville Theater in Boston, they were kind enough to let me screen six or seven prints of films, 70s movies, for the cinematographer, the production designer, the costume designer, and also for Dominic Sessa, because he hadn't really seen those movies, and I wanted him to get a sense of the movie he was about to be in. I ran The Graduate, The Landlord, Harold and Maude, The Last Detail, Clute, Paper Moon, and All the President's Men. We weren't trying to consciously emulate the look and feel of any single one of those films, but we all wanted to splash around the films of our contemporaries, had we been making a movie then.
I think that there's a lot of critics were comparing it to Hal Ashby movies, and I think he did Harold and Maude.
He did Harold and Maude.
That makes sense.
Number four, Paul Hunnam's lazy eye, which he also has in this movie. It's kind of a plot point that, like, Dominic Sessa, or, you know, Angus doesn't know which one to look at, and he asks him which one he should look at.
That's like a real, like, that's legit, man.
Paul Hunnam's lazy eye was, of course, Paul Giamatti's idea.
Of course.
It started out as a prank on Dominic Sessa before being worked into the script.
Interesting.
And apparently they kept, like, if you go back and watch the movie, they shifted it into each eye, so you would be as confused as he was.
Yeah.
And number five, Dominic Sessa said that the hardest scene for him to shoot was the ice skating scene.
Why? Because he was having fun and enjoying himself?
He found it difficult to fall on command because he's a hockey player.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. So that's my trivia.
That's great.
That's pretty much all I got.
Awesome. So let's do a little Oscar-y talk here.
Yep.
So every year we try to watch as many Oscar movies as we can.
We've watched every Best Picture nominee dating back to 2010, except for last year's Avatar: The Way of Water,
which we will eventually
which we'll
watch,
get to.
Yeah.
We'll get to.
So over the years, it's kind of shifted in how we do it. I would say that no matter what, we always try to watch at least one over the summer months that we think could be a potential nominee later on.
Shout out to our Barbenheimer episode. We covered two.
Yep. So luckily for us, we covered Barbie and Oppenheimer. We watched those in one day. That was really fun.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that.
Go back and listen to that if you watched them in the meantime, you know?
Yeah. And then back in the day, one year we had MoviePass.
Oh.
So that was great. We were able to watch Phantom Thread and a couple others.
17 or 18?
Something like that. We were able to watch a couple of them through MoviePass, where you paid $10 a month for unlimited movies.
What a terrible business model.
It was a lovely 6 months for us.
We reaped the rewards.
Although I felt like I just broke even, really. Like, I didn't watch all that many. We had friends that would, like, go all, like,
watch
a lot of movies.
Yeah.
And then as the pandemic happened and things also started kind of shifting more towards streaming, we found that it got easier and harder. It's easier because we can watch most of the movies in the comfort of our own home, which we now
for no additional cost.
For no additional cost. And we now have way less time and availability to go out.
Yes.
To watch.
Especially now that we have a kid.
Exactly. But at the same time, it causes some problems because movies get released later sometimes, or they may go somewhere that we don't have access to.
Well, the reason why we didn't watch Avatar is because it wasn't available. We like to stream movies. Like, we don't like to pirate movies. Mm-hmm. So, like, we're not, like, big into that. In case the FBI is listening.
We really aren't.
But that's what I'm going to say. That's the reason we didn't watch Avatar, because it wasn't out before the Oscar ceremony.
Right. Right. So far this year, we've probably seen, I think,
four of the Best Picture nominees,
as well as maybe a couple that will sneak in with, some other stuff.
Well, we have a possible fifth.
What is that?
May, December.
Oh yeah, I don't think that's going to end up being.
It's in the conversation.
It's definitely going to be nominated for.
You were talking about
Saltburn. I was talking about a couple.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But I mean, like, Saltburn's not getting nominated, but May December I think has a puncher's chance.
Yeah, sure. Charles Melton's definitely going to be nominated though.
Most likely.
Yeah.
You might get Portman or Moore too.
I liked May December.
Me too.
I thought that was a very good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles Melton I thought was the best part of that movie.
I think he's one of the best performances of the year.
Yeah, right.
I think it's maybe like him. I mean, of the ones I've seen, which we haven't seen, like Killers of the Flower Moon. We haven't seen a bunch
American
of like the
bigger Fiction.
Ones.
We haven't seen Past Lives. Yeah.
Yeah. But of the ones I've seen, I think Melton is probably like top three.
What's your favorite performance so far that you've seen?
Giamatti's up there, man.
He's so good.
Giamatti's up there. What else did we see? Oh, Cillian Murphy's excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Divine Joy Randolph, just in the same, in Holdovers as well.
And I feel, I'm kind of sad that Dominic Sessa isn't.
He had a moment like when it came out,
mm-hmm.
but it hasn't really, I think because the newcomer that they're going to give it to is Charles Melton. Like, like they're not really going to, it's rare that you see like two or three people you haven't heard of before in a,
well,
or
Lily,
not that you haven't heard necessarily.
Lily Gladstone and Divine Joy Randolph too are names that aren't exactly,
well, I mean,
everywhere
in,
yet.
I mean, in the same category.
Yeah, true.
But it's not that nobody's heard of Charles Melton because Riverdale had a lot of fans. But he's not known on like a prestige Oscar level at this point. He's not Academy well known.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm missing one.
Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling and Barbie, also excellent.
Mm-hmm.
There was one. What else did we watch? We watched Maestro.
Maestro. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we weren't big Maestro heads. I just think that we'll get more into this. We're doing a bonus Oscar episode with Uncle Nick P pretty soon in a couple weeks, so we'll get more into this then. But yeah, we weren't huge Maestro heads.
Yeah. What we're going to do is we can kind of move into our last thing here.
Yeah.
And kind of talk about the month ahead.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So, we did WALL-E, we're doing the Holdovers. So,
well, first you got to ask the big question.
Oh yeah. Does the Holdovers make Baby's First Watch List?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also shout out to me this entire episode for not calling it The Leftovers, because I've been doing that in my head constantly.
Yeah.
But no, it's The Holdovers.
It is.
And yeah, we are definitely putting it on Baby's First Watch List.
Definitely.
And like I said, I mean, I already said I'm going to, like, I could see this being a movie that I watch a lot of, you know, a lot over Christmas.
And it's rated R, but it's not anything crazy.
It's rated R for cursing, basically.
Yeah, language.
Which is, there's sizable, I would say, amount of cursing in this movie.
I didn't even notice that.
Well, I only did because it was like the big moments.
Yeah, sure.
He likes to punch with certain four letter words.
So what's the month looking like? We did WALL-E, you're right.
We did WALL-E.
Holdovers today.
Holdovers. Next week is, I believe, Sleepless in Seattle, or are we doing Mighty Ducks first?
Oh, I don't know, but I'm excited for both. I've seen Sleepless in Seattle. I have not seen Mighty Ducks.
The Mighty Ducks. Which we've heard that 2 is better. Our friends have told us that D2
knows?
Is better.
I probably will never find out.
What?
We'll see.
What are you talking about? but yeah, no, I think.
And then we're going to do Killers of the Flower Moon, right?
We're going to. Well, first of all, we're going to do. Yeah, so next week, I'm here. Sleepless in Seattle. The following week, we're going to do Mighty Ducks. That Thursday, after we do the Mighty Ducks on January 25th, we're going to drop our bonus episode, which is going to be our Oscar noms reaction with Uncle Nick P. We're going to do the same thing we did last year. We're going blind. We're going dark for the 23rd, which is the day they come out. We're going to record that night, and then our episode will come out on Thursday. And
so I'm not allowed to look it up?
You can if you want, but last year we went dark.
Oh, well, that was easier because I was like, oh, okay, yeah, okay, okay.
Yeah, he asked us.
I'll do it.
And finally, on the 30th, we will be doing Killers of the Flower Moon, which means we're going to watch a movie that's longer than Avatar.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm actually super excited for it. I think that it's been so long in the making and so
it's
anticipated.
It's going to be good.
And it's Scorsese. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I love Lily Gladstone, so it's going to be great.
Yeah, so this was The Holdovers, and we hope you enjoyed. And we hope you, if you haven't seen it yet, that you will watch it. Because I don't think that this isn't really a movie to me that's where spoilers matter.
No.
Like, if you haven't seen it, and obviously to you, if you listen to this whole thing, you don't care about spoilers either. But definitely watch it. It's great. It's cozy. It's heartwarming, without being, like I said, saccharine or melodramatic.
Yeah.
So thanks for tuning in, and you know, keep subscribing and, you know, sharing our clips and all. Sharing clips is actually great. You should share our clips on Instagram and TikTok and all that, if you like them. Anyway, this was The Holdovers, and we will see you next week for Sleepless in Seattle.
Bye-bye.
See you later.